back with episode 715 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and just because something's hinted at in the title doesn't mean it's actually going to happen.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm so thrilled about this, the opening of the non-network season.
That is certainly one way of putting it. We are going to be in this episode wrapping up our news for the week and then getting into the episodic discussion. And boy, would we have a much smaller list than what we've been used to throughout the spring. But first, before we do any of that, Edmund, if you don't mind giving a disclaimer.
Certainly. As we get into the episodes, we will talk about whatever we feel like. So if you haven't seen them, you'll be spoiled.
That's right, you will. And we're going to unfortunately start off with our In Memoriam section, which is typically at the end of our news role here, but we went a little bit longer in news, so we're going to cover it here. And Edmund, I believe you have the first entry.
Yes, this was the news that Michael Cimino died last week at the age of 77. Of course, he had a kind of odd career in terms of going from some very well-regarded films, starting out with Thunderbolt and Lightfoot in 1974. His second movie was The Deer Hunter in 1977, which went on to win 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director for himself. And his third was then the infamous Heaven's Gate, which wound up being such a flop that it actually caused the collapse of its studio, United Artists. And interestingly, I mean, you know, the actual numbers was the fact that it was being made for $44 million, which doesn't seem like so much nowadays, but of course back in 1980 was a huge amount, and then came out to much critical drubbing. Even though in recent years it has had a bit of a renaissance in its critical reception, but that failure not only took out United Artists, it did kind of affect his career as well. He certainly did not go on to have the sort of stellar career that people were expecting after The Deer Hunter. A few notable films, Year of the Dragon in 1985. Did a movie called The Sicilian, based on another novel by Godfather writer Mario Puzo. But unfortunately, his career never really returned to those heights he hit with The Deer Hunter. Given that time back in the 70s, he actually did make his name on Madison Avenue directing television commercials, similar to what Ridley Scott was doing over in England, but over here for Madison Avenue. But yes, was certainly an extremely talented director, and sad to see him go.
Indeed. We're 2016. You continue to disappoint me here. You're wiping the decks clean, it seems, and that's certainly true of our next entry here, Gary.
Oh, yes, and while she hasn't been in the spotlight lately, actually she has. You might just not have noticed. Who I'm talking about is the lovely Noelle Neal, who has passed on this year. She was the screen's first Lois Lane, after the radio plays had ended. She started to do the serial work in the movie theaters, along with the first... live-action Superman, Kirk Allen. And it was so popular, it had a sequel of serial productions in the early 1950. And then later on, after the TV series was decided to be introduced, she was brought in the second season to take over Lois Lane because it was felt that she would do a better job. She continued to be Lois Lane for another 5 years, doing over 100 episodes of the show. Much as we talked about with Supergirl, it's a tradition to have other people who are involved with Superman appear in other productions of it. She, along with Kirk Allen, appeared in the Superman, the movie with Christopher Reeve. She's also made guest appearances on the Adventure of Superboy TV series, as well as Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. Her latest role was also in Superman Returns. She played the rich old woman that Lex Luthor had talked out of her fortune. So, you know, she had been, you know, actively involved in the Superman franchise for many years. She would often go to conventions with her, you know, with a Superman S t-shirt on. And she was really an ambassador, you know, promoting the concept of Superman. And so she maintained a close relationship with DC Comics as a result of this. And there's a nice little story the former publisher Paul Levitz tells about when Hollywoodland, which is the story of George Reeves committing suicide, that you know he wanted to sort of have her go. He thought it would be a nice thing to do, and she was torn up what to do. Finally, she said, "Well, what would George want you to do?" And she said, "He wouldn't want me there." So she didn't go, and she always felt moved by George and tried to honor both him and the character, you know, throughout the rest of her life. And she did. So she had a long life. Was about 90. She died at the age of 95. And one thing, you know, in the 40s, you don't see it as much, but she had almost as much screen time as George Reeves ever did in the series. She often would take command of several parts of the episode with George just jumping in and out of windows while she had to do most of the exposition. So definitely a strong role model even back in the 40s.
Yeah, I it's actually kind of amazing to think just how much she was involved in the Superman lore all along. Far more than I think people realized, as you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. No, and I'll just chime in and mention that I can definitely attest to the strong role that they gave her in those TV episodes, because when I was in grade school in New York, we were always dashing home right after school, because at that point they actually had a syndicated block of Superman followed by Adam West Batman at about 4 o'clock, I think it was. So I got to see a lot of her and George Reeves and all that jumping out of movies and batting cardboard rocks aside.
Well, yes, once again, as I said, 2016 continuing to take away quite a bit from us collectively in terms of our celebrities and our film and entertainment history, really. Kind of dying on the vine here, unfortunately. But all right, let's move on to something a little bit better here. Let's move on to our, or at least a little more uplifting, and that is our episodic discussion. And let's go ahead. Let's start off with the bottom two. That's definitely a way to be uplifting. we only had 8 episodes this week. So bottom two, top two, that's all we're going to have. But we're going to go ahead and start here. I will say, first off, that there was not a huge spread in terms of scores this week. It was no higher than 8.5 and no lower than 7.2 roughly. So yeah, everything was above average, but it was not like we had any that were knocking out of the park on the level of, say, The Winds of Winter previously last week. But we did have some that were pretty solid, so we'll go ahead and talk about those in a little bit. But first, we have our bottom two, and the first one here on the list is coming in at 7.25, Clever Man, season 1, episode 5, A Man of Vision. Charlotte tries one last IVF procedure at a clinic that offers new technology. Slade offers Waru a tempting deal that may prove to be too good to refuse. And as I said, this came in at a 7.25. Mainly, I feel like, yes, things are kind of coming together plot-wise, but there are some plot elements that seem like they're really extraneous and don't have anything to do with the story per se. Edmund, how about you? What were your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, the way Slade, Ian Glenn's character, you know, is now sort of, we're now coming to the reveal of him as, you know, as more manipulative and potentially, it's going to be pretty much outright villainous, which had certainly been hinted at. And certainly the whole IVF procedure that yes, now does seem directly related to his hairy man, his clever man research, so that element at least is coming out. But one of my bigger issues is still more with the putative clever man himself. This reluctant, I really can't find any word other than wimpy to describe his sort of refusal to embrace what's going on. I was kind of astonished at this whole bounty being put on his head, and they seem to be setting it up for what to me felt like a classic moment out of Babylon 5 when Garibaldi sells out Sheridan at the bar when they're on the beach, and instead it just winds up being this kind of angsty argument between the two of them, and you know, so I mean, it's that part of the story that's that's still grating on me. I mean, you know, and I'm hoping that, you know, yeah, it's coming to this moment at the end of this episode where, you know, he does see the little girl who got killed right back at the beginning, you know, sort of gets to make his apologies to her, you know, might be leading, you know, leading at least that character, you know, embracing what you know is apparently a major element of that's going to drive this story forward, you know. But this is all with one episode to go, and sort of sloppy way which they've been bringing all these elements forward or hinting at these elements, and not really developing them. It's not a case of coming out of a penultimate episode with all sorts of excitement for the finale. It's just hoping they can do better.
Yeah, this whole season, I think we've talked about this before, has come across very much as just a mere introduction, especially when it comes to these extraneous plot pieces that are just kind of in there, this series mythology that has been oft mentioned but never actually introduced into the series. Mm-hmm. It just seems like this is supposed to be the opening just to introduce you to what the story really could and should be about later, and I feel like that's a very... questionable way to go about it.
Yeah,
because the introduction doesn't actually give you much to work with.
Exactly, and there was even another element that occurred to me. You know, watching this fifth episode was listening more closely to the opening theme. And realizing it's like, wait a minute, they're using this boxing metaphor in the theme, basically hit the body and the head will follow. And there's been this background element of these fights and these guys training and whacking punching bags and stuff. But they haven't developed sort of that part of the society, which, you know, certainly could be an interesting element of, you know, yes, all of these extremely strong, hairy men, getting co-opted, into this, some version of MMA fighting culture, you know, and that being their main ticket to try and achieve some success or notoriety or independence. But we haven't really seen anything concrete about that. Just that one fight at the beginning, and no sense of that being a sort of exploitative undercurrent of their culture.
No, and what it seems like is that this is maybe the classic example of a creative type going and getting the opportunity to make something and coming up with this really intricate backstory and this whole society and everything, and then failing to actually exploit that in any way in the actual story.
Yes.
It's kind of like, you see this happen all the time where there's this book with this great background, but the actual story really has nothing to do with any of it. And it never actually factors in, which is exactly what we're seeing here. What I came away with in this episode is that we've got three key relationships that are part of that the story surrounds. None of those relationships actually have anything to do with the mythology that has been released in other places. One of them, it's a couple having a problem with conception.
Yep.
The other one is that the clever man, despite all of these aborning abilities, can't seem to do something as simple as stay away from his best friend's girlfriend. And I mean, this is what the story is about. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag, unfortunately. The concept is really there if it had been implemented, even in the ways that you mentioned that were very niche. They're not exploiting them in that way here.
No.
So that means that we can still say, though, that there is one episode that is scoring lower this week, and unfortunately it is a repeat showing here at the bottom of the list, and that is Wayward Pine, Season 2, Episode 6, City Upon a Hill. Teresa is put in grave danger, and the town's food supply is critically low after the Abbey's attack CJ and the Harvesters. And this one came in at an average of 7.17. And, the stakes are rising, but the characters are still, the central characters are just not that engaging. At least that's how I feel. How about you, Gary?
I personally like the idea of the Abbeys becoming a credible threat to try and focus the town on what's important and to move forward that way. But the the squabbling and the, I guess, the fundamental arguments aren't going by the wayside when they're going to start starving soon. I sort of scratch my head that everybody isn't coming together a little bit better and that they don't consider the Abbey as a threat seems a little ludicrous at this point. If nothing else, just for their sheer numbers versus their any talk about planning or intelligence that they seem to throw around. So, at first I thought, oh, that's great. They're going to get out of the internal politics a little bit. We'll have our traditional sort of, them versus us, maybe with a few twists in the middle, and it might work out okay. And they're not giving up on the internal struggling one bit, which sort of is depressing to me. And number two, while the, and it's taking away time from developing the Abbey's more of a threat. If in some ways they could go in either direction, and trying to go in both at the same time is getting them nowhere fast. So I hope they focus on a main point they want to go with and move forward. But I don't think this is a large season, and they're already six episodes in. So where the heck are they going to go with this? I don't think they'll get where they need to be.
Yeah, I mean, we both of the shows that are at the bottom of the list here are shows that are showing a bit of lack of direction, it seems, almost. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for me, I mean, it was, exactly what Gary was talking about. I mean, I was really annoyed at, our young, callow, naive leader, refusing to acknowledge that the Abbeys might have some intelligence and coordination, just because it's, just because Pilcher didn't think they did. Given the gravity of the situation that they've built up and how tiny the community is, it did kind of beggar belief that this is a situation that could ever resolve itself to actually allow them to survive the way it's been set up so far. As with Cleverman, some interesting concepts in terms of trying to build a static community like this, and too much reverence for the founder and his beliefs, but the way it's getting executed, it's just not intriguing me at all. it's one of these cases of, okay, you've got yourself into this situation, and I'm not really caring about what the solution's going to be.
Yeah, I can't exactly argue with that. Let's see here. That means that we can move on to the top two for the week, and we have actually a couple shows that maybe because some other heavy hitters are now off the roster, we can see them shine a bit. And so in our number two slot, coming in at an 8.0, we have Powers, Season 2, Episode 6, Requiem. An important member of the community is murdered as Callista is set to be crowned a shining star of the Powers universe by the CEO of a powerful merchandising company. With Walker and Pilgrim serving their suspension, the city begins to unravel around them. That pretty well covers it. Like I said, this one came in at an average of 8, which is probably the highest that it's been this season, or at least pretty representative of the best of the season. And I was kind of surprised to see them pull a pretty strong plot trigger here in the sixth episode of the season.
Yeah, absolutely. My tongue-in-cheek reaction was, we have talked about sort of budgetary issues on this show from time to time, and given what happened, it did make me wonder. It's like, oh, so you couldn't afford to keep Will Wheaton around any longer. But even though it certainly made perfect sense in terms of the plot that they had been developing, and just how nastily perverse and loathsome his character was. Major reshuffling of the players and some interesting battle lines being drawn now that we're getting a better sense of who the assassin is. The whole Tricia Helfer and the feds taking over the Powers division and leaving our heroes off on their own to try and combat things in their own way, it seems. So yeah, I thought it was a nice little twist, as opposed to after six episodes of Wayward Pines, I'm rather interested to see what's going to happen in these last two episodes.
Yeah, it does seem like they've got to get a lot done in those episodes. That's for sure. But at any rate, yeah, just the fact that they went ahead and solved the murder here versus at the end of the season, like I was anticipating.
Yeah,
a little surprising. All right, our number one show for the week. This one comes in as a bit of a surprise because we've been talking less than glowingly of the show the last couple of weeks, but here we are. The Musketeers, Series 3, Episode 6, Death of a Hero. The Musketeers must restore order in Paris after a homicidal lunatic escapes prison. Well, that's kind of the
sort of
plot
what
of the episode.
Yeah,
but boy, a lot more happens than that, and a lot better things happen than that. It's a big jump back in the right direction. I think this is actually one of the best episodes, if not the season, then the series. The writing in this episode was just came out of nowhere, it felt like.
Yeah, definitely. Because I mean, certainly the main plot driver is this threat to the Musketeers from Grimaud and Rupert Everett's character, who's name I'm the king's half brother, but then really pulling the trigger on seeking to ambush everybody, but then with some very nice twists. I mean, certainly the whole thing when Aramis gets called away, and I'm thinking, you know, at first I'm thinking, oh, this is part of it, you know they want to split them up, because try and take them on one on one, only to discover that no, the king really did ask for him, and yes, just as he had been fearing all along, it wasn't just to accompany him on a pilgrimage; it was to finally take him to task for bedding his wife, and certainly between the title "Death of a Hero" and the way they opened the episode with this whole monologue about how one faces one's faces one's death on the day you're going to die, and certainly with D'Artagnan. Porthos, when they're cornered in their sort of Butch and Sundance moment, and start talking about things like, oh, you know, you're so happy with your wife, and I'm all alone, and D'Artagnan's, oh, I'm sure you'll find a wonderful woman and have children, and you're like, oh, goody, yeah, so they're setting up both of them to potentially be the one to die.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking.
In classic foreshadowing fashion.
Yes.
But then at the same time, I mean, the way they were doing that before, with everybody, I did start to get an inkling of, oh, wait a minute. Yes, maybe it isn't that any of the Musketeers are going to die. It's going to be someone else. And sure enough, it's Rupert Everett. Taking a knife to the gut and by proclamation of the king being buried and deemed a hero, despite the fact he's been basically the villain the entire series. So yeah, just some. So I mean, in addition to the usual, of course, actions and booms and sword fights and gunfights and things that the show always delivers. Some very nice twists and turns along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Having Faron be then the quote-unquote hero in this case after foreshadowing everything, one of the nice touches is that we know that as we get very close now to the end of the series,
yes,
not everybody can possibly survive.
Right.
And so doing this now was a really nice way of playing on that because I, like you were alluding to, I felt like at least two characters were potentially going to go. not the least of which was either D'Artagnan or Porthos. So yeah, this was one of those episodes where I was really starting to feel like, oh, this is the one where we have to say goodbye to somebody.
Yeah.
And it made everything a little bit stronger in my opinion. And then for them to turn it about your expectations, it was like, oh, that was actually quite clever. And it almost redeemed the character of Faron in the process. If it wasn't for the fact that the king is someone who is utterly deplorable and you hate, but even he has some degree of sympathy in this episode because he is, in fact, the wronged party, mm-hmm. Despite the fact that he is despicable and he kind of asked for it. one has to keep that in mind. It's not as though he is, you know, the one who is in the wrong when it comes to that whole relationship.
Absolutely.
So it's yeah, there's a lot going on in this episode, and as I said, it really, if anything, it makes the two previous episodes look even worse because that they come out of that slump with this.
Yeah,
it's like, wow, this is what the series should have been from the beginning, and this is like everything that's good about the series put into one, you know, 50-minute romp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is the show that I'm going to miss.
Oh, absolutely, and certainly with the King. I mean, you know, I think they've done some very interesting things. I mean, where, you know, they haven't, you know, completely rehabilitated him or anything, but they have given him more nuance. I think between the introduction of his illness, and then him finally confronting Aramis in this episode. And I did like the fact that Aramis didn't just take it. He did throw back at him with that he was cavorting around and parading Milady, his mistress, you know, in front of his wife, and disrespecting her in all those different ways, given his character and the fact that, you know, yes, they were alone, you know, he wasn't just going to sit there and take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, deservedly so, that the Musketeers is up at the top of our list this week. That means that we have a couple returning shows that are going to be more in the middle of the pack, although a couple of these just a little bit low, I would say. The first of those episodes here in the middle of the pack, as I was saying, is Killjoys, Season 2, Episode 1, Dutch and the Real Girl. In the Season 2 premiere, Dutch and Johnny have failed to rescue Davin from Arkin when they travel to Eulogy, an outlaw-only barter town, in the hopes of stealing a mysterious high-tech shield from the infamous Conover gang. And this one comes in at an average of 7.83. And, the only thing that I actually didn't like about this episode really was the new opening. I liked the first one better.
Oh, okay.
But there, that's all. It had a little more spunk to it, in my opinion, and a little more real Dutch, shall we say. But yeah, Gary, you didn't like it quite as much as we did. I mean, you still gave it above average for sure. But yeah, what were your thoughts on this premiere?
I'm not sure. It felt like maybe it's the production or the direction. It just the show felt a little different. I still recognized a lot of it, but it had a little bit of a different flavor to it. It felt like maybe the opening did it for me. I'm not sure, but I think I might need an episode or two to settle into it. I'm glad to see everybody back, but I didn't expect them to be where they were, I guess, is how this season opened up.
Edmund, how about you?
Yeah, to my mind, yeah. I mean, I like the way they were sort of, jumping in. I mean, you know, in the middle of this operation, it didn't, I'm certainly given what had happened at the end of the first season. It was sort of, you know, slightly having to play catch up at first, but once I did, I really did enjoy the ride, and the way they've been sort of building on the chemistry that the team developed in that first season, but at the same time, I mean, sort of automatically, in introducing these new elements in terms of Kai Len and what his motives might actually be, and what other forces are at play within the rack, so I was enjoying it quite a bit, I was fine with the opening myself, I will say those simulations I had Davin going through were okay, but they were nowhere near as good as the ones in 6741. And yes, that is our weekly person of interest reference halfway through show two for those in the pool.
Yeah, a little later than we're used to, but there you are. If you are coming in around this time in episode two, please email for your inevitable reward, which will be a phone call from Samaritan giving you your last instructions before being subsumed. Anyway, I don't know. There is something about the production, but I don't know if it's all that different. I think it's just that they are maybe doubling down is maybe not the right word for it. What would I use as the words for this? maybe they're just being a little more confident about going with this slightly over-the-top, almost campy style that they had even in the first season, but that they're really just going all out on their style this time around. And maybe that was a little off-putting. I don't know. But I did notice that, boy, did they just come out of the gate really very much the what I remember about the show being irreverent,
wisecracking,
not afraid to, wisecracking, all that. But more just, they know they're a little bit low budget, but they almost make it work for them. It is really an evolution, as we've said before, of the kind of like, hey, we're in the Firefly universe, but this is maybe another corner of it. I could easily see it being that. And it still feels that way. And I like the characters. I like the kind of tongue-in-cheek way that they deal with things. I love the use of, you know, unusual soundtrack choices. It's a show that wears its weirdness on its sleeve, and I think that it works for it. And it makes the more serious moments hit with a lot more punch, I feel. So I liked it coming back. I think what we're going to find is that while a couple of us maybe felt very differently about the other show that debuted on its new season on Friday night, Gary, I think that you hit the reverse. So I'll be curious to see if we're just looking for different things out of these two shows. But as far as I'm concerned, this one is just one where I can kind of sit back and enjoy them chewing the scenery like crazy. Because they really are, quite frankly.
Yeah, but certainly, I mean, in terms of that sort of irreverence and the team dynamics, I mean, you know, this season was feeling, you know, even more like a Michelle Lovretta show, of course, the creator of Lost Girl, than even the first season did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. Okay, so next on the list is The Last Ship, Season 3, Episode 4, Devil May Care. Chandler confronts a possible new foe. In other developments, Slattery makes discoveries about the supposed viral mutation, and President Minchner is pressured as problems deepen. Boy, my screen did something funny there. But anyway, this one came in at an average of 7.5, and literally, we all give this one a 7.5. I'm just going to say, for me, the politics, the power plays, these are all the things that we predicted would take place. It still feels like this show is like almost this weird kind of redo of Crusade, exactly where we expected things to go. But something feels a little off for me. I don't know what it is, but it just feels like there's something missing from the show this season. And I can't put my finger on it. Gary, what about you? I mean, you also gave this a 7.5. What were your thoughts on the reasons why?
Well, for me, while we talk about the politics, and I'll refer to it as stateside, I find the split in focus to be slightly off-putting to me as I'm trying to keep the story in my head going and build up tension for it. Also, in some ways, there's no immediate threat to us the way there was with the violence. Yes, you have somebody massing power on the other side of the world, but it's still not gosh, that could be years away before it really does something. So there's an urgency to the problem or what they're trying to fix that isn't there this season, or that there was, obviously last season. So maybe that's the driving purpose to, hurry up, get things done, because, everything is going to, die if we don't do that. Now it's a lot more, politics and, more, problems around the world. And it's not that humanity is going to die off anymore. And so I think you've lost that sort of urgency that the show portrayed as strongly last season. I mean, you see it a little bit when they're trying to go rescue people and things of that nature, but it's not this sort of overwhelming push that's in the back of your head through the old show. Hurry up, we got to get things done, or everyone's dead. It's just, oh, geez, relations aren't going well with the guy who's taking over China. Oh, we're going to have to, figure out what's going on and fix it. But it's not that pressing urge. And maybe that's the tension that seems to be missing out of the show a bit this season.
Maybe. Edmund, how about you? What are your thoughts on this episode and the season so far?
Yeah, I think part of it is that to a certain extent, they have, I think, kind of gotten bogged down in this hostage drama, with the top leadership, being held by the Helix scientist for some reason. I think that's part of what's detracting. And certainly the whole immediacy see last season of having, you know, this literal nuclear threat hanging over the proceedings. I find it kind of odd that now we're dealing with whatever remains of China, and there's been talk about the military, their military capabilities, but that sort of ultimate threat has been removed for now. And also with this episode, the whole covert op into the Chinese president's mansion, I was fine with, except for a show that's been so committed to being as realistic as possible, I did not understand why they had it. They'd gotten everything they needed, and then they were just hanging out until daybreak, rather than getting out of there under the cover of darkness, so they could just walk out and be surrounded by the security chief who'd managed to figure things out by that point, just so they could have the president then say, oh no, you need to let them go. And that just completely rang false to me.
Yeah, that was one of those plot points that just didn't seem to add up. That's for sure. Maybe it is that the urgency isn't quite as potent this season, and that's what's affecting the hook, so to speak.
But that's cool. So Kitty ended.
Anyway, let's see. Next on the list is Dark Matter. Season 2, Episode 1, Welcome to Your New Home. In the Season 2 premiere, the crew awaken to find themselves being held prisoners in the Hyperion Maximum Security Galactic Detention Facility. And this one came in at an average of 7.33. And boy, we were all over the map with this one.
Yes, we were.
For me, the issue here is that the show just still seems to have a very slow pace. Feels like it's crawling. I'll say this in terms of the difference between Killjoys and Dark Matter. I feel like Killjoys moves fast. This moves deadly slow. And that alone is a big difference, in my opinion, between the two shows and in terms of my enjoyment of it, because I literally got to the middle of this episode and thought we were at the end of it, hit pause and looked and went, oh, God, really? So that, it's not good when you feel like the show is just never going to end. Like, get to the point already, guys. That kind of feel. Also, I really still don't buy that explanation they gave for that plot twist at the end of the finale.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like they glossed over that way too easily.
Yeah, well, unless it's something where, that's not going to be the real reason.
It's possible, I guess.
But even if that's what they're setting up, it's still been clumsily done. But for me, it's a continuation of my issues from last season. We have now moved on to where they're actually finding out their real names rather than just being numbers. But the characters are still feeling very simplistic and one-dimensional to me, and a lot of the plotting is as well. A lot of this just felt like standard sort of prison drama, prison escape stuff going on. And then sort of combined with the corporate power play stuff that was done much better over on Continuum, which was automatically brought to mind because that condo we wound up in looked a lot like old Alex Kondo back in 2070, whatever it was, on Continuum. For me, I was not finding it that engaging. I'm still not that interested in the characters, and even that little twist at the end of the criminal who he had himself plastic surgeried to look like his back, and now will presumably be trying to take his place, but even that isn't interesting me too much. I'm not finding that very interesting because I didn't have that much invested in the original version of the character. But I remember from last season that it was very interesting, the reaction to these two shows. It seemed to be that in most cases people really liked Killjoys and didn't like Dark Matter, and then there are people who really liked Dark Matter and didn't care for Killjoys as much. So I know for me personally that seems to be holding over into this second season.
Gary,
Yeah,
you seemed to like this quite a bit more.
I did like it more. I enjoyed the storyline. I enjoy the overarching sort of conspiracy that's continuing to go on. This GA group that we really only had a partial viewing of the first season. Now we're starting to see more of it. We're starting to see that the conspiracy against the Ryza people is even more involved and dense than we thought. It involves everybody from a multi-million dollar corporations through the entire chain of law enforcement. And the scope of it is pretty good. Admittedly, the only part that really falls short for me isn't the story, it's the acting. The actors generally are sort of quasi unemotional. They just don't seem there. I guess I'll use the term phoning it in for me, and that does take me out of it a little bit. But at the same time, I think the story is really good. I like it a lot. I'm enjoying the new relationship that is having to form between all the crew of the Ryza for now different reasons, but still because everyone is out to get them. So I'm enjoying it. I know what you're saying. It is slow, but I think that's more because it's sort of this whole big conspiracy thing as opposed to a shoot 'em up, which is a lot of times what Killjoys becomes. So, I like them both. This one is a little slow burn, but I have good hopes for it. It started out a little slow the first season, too, if I remember correctly. A lot of ambiguity and not understanding what they're doing or where they're going. So I hope they'll pull it out this season. So, but I'm enjoying it so far. And contrary to Edmund, I love the twist at the end where the guy got shot to death. I was like, ooh. So that's exciting to me. And I like that little, that mix up that will occur as a result of it, and the questions and hiding and all that sort of stuff. Seems interesting to me.
Yeah, maybe it's because I felt like the show kind of got away from itself last season, and I've never really been able to engage with the characters all that well. So this whole idea that, are they alive? Are they not alive? Are they the real ones? Are they not the real ones? Who's who? It's kind of elusive to me because I didn't care about the characters all that much to begin with. They never really gave me too much to work with because, of course, for most of the first season, they were pretty much a blank slate. I don't know that they're much more than that now either, so maybe the rest of the season is going to actually start getting me to identify these characters a little bit better and want them to be the kind of like ones rising to the top in some fashion. But for right now, I'm still not sure exactly what the show is trying to be. It's got some good elements, but yeah, something's missing, I guess.
Okay, I see your concern. I'm not dismissing it. It's just the story seems to be working for me.
Yeah, that's good. Hopefully, as we go along, we'll kind of figure out exactly what the differences are, and maybe they're not as big as we think they are. Let's face it. Right now, we just have a very large diversity of opinion on this show, so maybe it's just them trying to clear the decks from the first season, and we'll see what the second season really turns out to be. Finally on this list, we have Preacher, Season 1, Episode 6, Sundowner. Jesse finally comes face-to-face with DeBlanc and Fjord and learns about the mysterious entity that has taken over his body. And this one came in at an average of 7.25, so it could have been in the bottom two, but I think that Clever Man just kind of edged it out. Again, a lot's going on. There's this feeling that something's going somewhere, but I'm just not sure what and to what extent. So it is still a show that is eluding me to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we're getting more explanations this time around. We now have a name for the entity that it is Genesis, and it's some strange spawn of an angel and a demon. We had a hugely over the top battle between seraphim and angels at the beginning, meanwhile there's stuff going on in the town and around the church and around these off the wall characters who we've been introduced to, but it's still just feeling very disjointed, and I'm not getting a real sense of the story coming together, certainly the sort of little shock twist at the end, Jesse's angry go to hell, which we presumably we will get more elucidation on down the road. But then again, the way this show has been going, I'm not really sure how much. But at this point, it's still holding my interest enough, just because it is so strange and weird.
Yeah, it's strange and weird, and that's good enough. I want some sense of where this is going.
Yeah.
Like, what? Why am I supposed to care about this? Things are just happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
I mentioned that last week, so I'm not feeling all that much different this week, I guess you could say.
But certainly, I mean, you know, the way they started bringing up all this, you know, angel and demon stuff, and you know, and how the way angels, you know, and in this universe anyway, can resurrect, the weirdness factor. I mean, I'm starting to feel like this is sort of the strange bastard child of Supernatural and Twin Peaks, but not necessarily up to the quality of either.
Mm. Yeah, I'm still waiting for it to pull out that episode that's going to make it all, like, click. And, I mean, this one almost was being praised enough to make me think that it was, in fact, going to be that, but then no. So I'm still waiting for this show to show me what it is, if that makes any sense. But there we are. All right, that means that we are done with our episodic discussion. And, Edmund, how much time do we have left for this episode?
We are at about 53 minutes. So
53 minutes. Okay, well, what we're going to go ahead and do next time is that we have at least part of the episode, which is going to be a rundown of our rundown of the past year. And kind of a recap and a look back at the 2015 to 2016 season. And then we have some feedback from some of our listeners. So we still have quite a bit that we want to cover this week. So stay tuned.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.